Welcome to Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. I'm your host, Daniel Kirbine, and I am on the phone with Mike Sosaby, who is a filmmaker who has embarked on a rather unique project, which has to do with, well, you can tell by the title, Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time. It's not just heady stuff. We're talking about people who are really getting prepared for what this future is bringing us. So having seen a trailer for that, we had to get Mike Sosaby on Shift Shapers to talk to our listeners. Mike, thank you for joining us here on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio.
Hey, Daniel, how you doing?
Just great. And yeah, you have some things coming up here. And before we get to that, I want to find out, just everyone's got their story or their kind of Moses moment or their thing about, hey, this great big epiphany happens and nothing's quite the same anymore as far as the message they're putting out. And I'm kind of seeing that in the kind of film that you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came into filmmaking and a little bit about how you've taken this direction toward doing a film about Guy McPherson and the intentional transitional living and things of that nature?
Well, I kind of need to start early on because my father got stationed in Las Vegas, Nevada in the early 60s when I was a kid. We had left Georgia and moved out to Las Vegas. I ended up growing up in Las Vegas. And when I arrived there, one of the things that was unique about Las Vegas is here you are in the middle of this desert, and they were advertising on these billboards that free water.
Yeah.
It was public service. You just got free water, as much water as you wanted. We had a big lawn, and we would just turn on the sprinkler, and we just never turned it off because it was free water. And we'd be out there playing with water, and it was so tasty. It was like drinking champagne. It was so beautiful. And about 1966, all of a sudden one day they say the water's gone, and
ooh,
we're gonna have to hook you up to lake water. And all of a sudden, you know, I was about 11 years old, and I said, wow! All of a sudden, this nasty water started coming on the pipes, and what I didn't realize at the time, but as I kind of discovered, is we were drinking fossil water. It had been there for 12,000 years after the last ice age, and we went through it in a decade, just sucking it out of the ground. And all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I kind of saw limits to growth. So when I got to college and I saw the Limits to Growth book that was, you know, that kind of, you know, changed people's perspective.
Yeah, that was a breakthrough
about
book.
Things. So I kind of started looking at these limits a long time ago when I was a young person. But, you know, I think a lot of people, after the environmental movement started and everybody got excited about that, and, we got the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and we were doing all these wonderful things. And then we stopped because we all got jobs and we got BMWs, and we wanted big TVs, and we wanted the life,
mm-hmm.
and we did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a jam. It was a lot of fun. You know, but what we didn't realize is very much the same way the situation with the water in Las Vegas. We've now gone through this storage of compressed energy in the form of oil, which is solar energy in a compressed form, and it's running out very quickly, and we're now... we've gone past the peak of conventional oil production. That means if you poke a hole in the ground, you suck it out, that's conventional oil production. We peaked in 2006. Some people will say maybe later, but conventional oil production definitely has peaked. Now we're looking at non-conventional oil production, which is deep water drilling, and then
mm-hmm.
we've got the tar sands in Alberta, which is it's not even actually an oil drilling operation.
No.
It's a mining operation where they cut down forests and they pull the land out and they heat it at 760 degrees centigrade using the Athabasca River and the water and the Athabasca Delta, one of the last pristine water system, pristine areas in North America. And we're going to destroy a watershed for a few puffs of gas. And it's just obscene.
It's really about enough to keep our supplies, satisfy our thirst for oil for a month or maybe a year. I don't remember what the figure is, but it's really not much. It's not going to last us long.
Well, actually, you know, the amount of oil that's available in the tar sands, as long as you're willing to destroy an area the size of Florida and just turn it into a toxic moonscape, it's actually pretty. It's a pretty healthy amount of oil. We're pulling 3 million, close to 3 million barrels a day out of the tar sands right now. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about ramping it up. I don't know how they're going to do it, but they want to do it. The amount of carbon that's being released out of there is probably equivalent to the cars driving on all the roads in the United States. That's how filthy this operation is. And people are sitting there saying, oh, well, you know, Barack Obama's going to get elected, and, yeah, he's going to have to approve the tar sands, because what are you going to do? We need the oil. And I see us sleepwalking into the end of the world. And I don't see any leadership at the top. I see the most craven group of elite have captured the government. And so me as a person, I look at this and I think, I see this coming because I read, and I've read a lot in my life, and I've always been a reader. And I've read people that have been talking about this issue for a long, long time, going back to James Howard Kunstler, going back mm-hmm. to the book Collapse of Complex Societies by Painter. That's over 20 years old. Mm-hmm. This is not new information. It's not esoteric. But unfortunately, I see my children growing up, and they are functionally illiterate. That means they are able to read and write, but they don't read nor write.
Yeah, and there's
very much.
And like you said, there's
might tweet you.
There have been plenty of opportunities, like you're saying. I'm going to interject a little bit here and follow your thread here, which is that there have been lots of opportunities to see this coming. You've read Jim Kunstler's books. You've been on this trajectory here where seeing that oil is peaking and putting 2 + 2 together and having an equal 4, and yet we have this. I don't know. Like Guy McPherson calls it the industrial civilization, or we have the 1%, whatever you want to call it, is telling us no. You have to put 2 and 2 together and have it equal 5, because you know we're really getting hit in the face with this. With anyone who looks clearly, and I'm hearing you say this, can see that we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel for this oil we're trying to get.
Well, it's very much the same way that we go through all of our resources. Right now, the Ogallala Aquifer, the largest aquifer in North America, they're sucking it dry to irrigate the Midwest, and they're going to more and more marginal water. The watersheds are now so concentrated now, whatever pollutants that have been gone into the system because of the irrigation, because of the amount of pesticides and fertilizers they're putting onto these systems, the water that they're irrigating the crops in the Midwest, which is what most of us are eating at the grocery store,
right,
are absolutely toxic. The food that we're getting at the grocery store is toxic. And people need to say, be afraid a little bit. And I think the fact that young people don't seem to be very frightened really frightens me, because I'm saying there is a clear and present danger of not seeing this. And once you see it, if we wait too much longer, it's going to be too late to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. So there could be a cost for this need or this demand that we have these days that you must be positive about all these things. Now, you saw the 11th Hour film, right?
I saw 11th Hour, yeah.
And that was one of the biggest complaints and bad reviews about it, was it wasn't positive enough. It was way too negative.
Well, here was the thing. There was who was the actor that produced that film? What was his name?
I don't remember. Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm going to edit this and take this part out.
Okay.
I'm supposed to know these things.
DiCaprio was the producer. It's 2 weeks after that event. He's chartering a private jet to go to Hawaii to show up to his friend's wedding at some special. And I thought, here's the guy that produced the film and didn't look at the material and say, wait a second, man, this is about all of us. We're all complicit in the crime.
Mm-hmm.
We're all driving around in cars. We know what's going on, and we're still driving around in cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I posted something yesterday. I don't know whether you got a chance to see it. Mike Sliwa.
Where? Oh, that one about who the other people that you've got in the film.
Well, you know, there's quite a few people who were actually in this film.
Yeah.
But they were a couple that had lived at Guy McPherson's.
Right. I saw it. Oh, yeah, I saw it all right. Yeah, he's very articulate about what they're doing and why.
But, you know, when he kind of caught up with this, with Guy McPherson, and Guy McPherson was, this is when he was publishing all of his articles in the Arizona Star, and people are reading this, and it's like, it's alarming to people.
Right.
Now, they couldn't fire Guy McPherson at the University of Arizona because he was a tenured professor. But the fact that they went after Guy McPherson on what he was teaching academically, to attack him in a very proactive way, bring in a department chair to get rid of Dr. Guy McPherson,
mm-hmm.
what he was saying was such a threat to an Ivy League college, because University of Arizona is a prestige college.
Right, and I'm going to catch the listeners up to what you're talking about here, because what I'm talking to Mike Sosaby. You're listening to Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio. I'm your host, Daniel Kirvine, and I'm talking to filmmaker Mike Sosaby about his current film project, which is Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time. The subject of the film is a professor, and he's a professor emeritus now, but he was an active tenured professor at the University of Arizona in the environmental education program, steeped in biology and science and oceanography, all of that. He was alarmed over where things are going ecologically, started writing articles about it, and the university started going after him. That's what you're describing here, Mike. I thought I'd give the background on that, and this is actually what's motivating
that,
your film.
Because, you know, that kind of brings it somewhat up to date, but it was a whole saga. And one of the things that he talked about specifically in the film and kind of brought his story out was, it was a war that the president of the University of Arizona had basically over this piece of saguaro garden that was at the University of Arizona. And they were going to remove that garden. And Guy McPherson, who had seen the garden disappear from what it was in the 60s, it was a mile-long, super ecological event. I mean, it was one of the talking points of the college, and over the years they had cut it back and cut it back until it was a small remnant of what it originally was. They've got pictures at the University of Arizona of kids out there painting the squirrel landscape, and they were doing environmental studies, and it was so large.
Mm-hmm.
So they cut it back, and it's now just a minor garden. And when they had hired a San Francisco firm to go in and replace that squirrel forest with some pavers and a fountain, he writes a letter to the university president, and the university president ignores him. He sends him another one, a little firmer, and once again he's ignored. Well, the third one he sent a copy to the Arizona Star, and they published it as an editorial. Well, next thing you know, they've got protest groups out at the university, and they've got the students organized. Anyway, they said, okay, we're not going to put the pavers in, and we're not going to do all that stuff, and we're going to save the garden. And so he won the battle, but what they decided to do is this president, first thing he did was bring in a chair who's willing to get rid of Guy McPherson.
Wow.
So it was a political hit job, and they said, you can no longer teach your classes, even the classes that you were taught, that you invented, you wrote the curriculum for these classes, you wrote the textbooks, and you wouldn't even allow him to teach the courses. The only thing he was allowed to do is he could teach prisoners. And he, rather than just say, okay, I'll just sit home and collect my six-figure salary, he actually went to the prison and began to teach prisoners how to write poetry. And it changed his life in a large way, but he says, I'm a teacher. I've got to teach. And the message he's carrying is something that, you know, affects a lot of people, myself included.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, my wife and I probably are going to kind of do our own walking away later on this year.
Well, that is part of what Guy McPherson is advocating. And I want to inject something here, too. I would have been surprised at Arizona doing something like that, a university in Arizona doing something like that, if it hadn't been for what already I knew of that they had done with ethnic studies and Chicano studies in the Tucson school district, and banned all the books, and they including Shakespeare. Shakespeare's The Tempest. No kid in school can read The Tempest. Can you believe that? In Arizona, no child in school.
I saw that, and I look at it, and that kind of brings me back to why I'm doing this film, because most young people don't read, and it's not, like I said, they're functionally illiterate. I think most young people, and I have two grown-up men, sons, that both of them are college-educated, they got degrees, and you go in their home, they might have a stack of DVDs, and they can email 10,000 friends or whatever, and they can communicate instantly, but they don't read anymore. There's no reading, and they come out of college, and they're not trained in any type of liberal arts education. They're trained to be corporate slaves.
Right.
And I've told them that, and it offends them. They don't want to hear when I talk about what's kind of coming, because they've got their lives planned, and they say, "Dad, man, you had your life. Don't screw mine up," because they've got their plans. And I think, they're not going to be able to fulfill those plans based on resource constraints. It's just not going to happen.
Well, it's something that those of us who have seen what's coming with the future, and we've taken a hard look at what the supply line looks like. Yeah, exactly. And just to wrap that up here, is that is a connection that it makes a lot of sense when you see that, we don't want critical thinking. And that's what Guy McPherson was all about with his articles, and that's also what the Chicano studies are all about, is critical thinking, question, for the good of the culture and the good of the earth, too. So too much critical thinking, can't have it.
In one of the books they banned was The People's History of the United States by the great Howard Zinn.
Yeah.
And that was, you can't take the myth of America and start slamming it like Zinn did, accurately, and we're not going to let you get away with that in Arizona. We've got to keep the myth going.
Yeah, and so where Guy McPherson went to is from his book. One of his book titles is "Walking Away from Empire," and I'm hearing that you're referring to that and saying that that's something that you are inspired to actually do, and you've crafted this film around what that looks like. Walking away from empire.
Yeah, because the people that are interviewed in it, some of them, like the most recent one, would be the one that I posted about Mike and Karen Sleeler.
Mm-hmm.
They're now woofing, and they're in Italy. Now, they're not young people. They're in their 40s. And, you think of woofing, you think of young people in their 20s that are they're able to do the physical work. But I'm 57. And I'm saying, okay, I'm going to have to get it. I started getting myself in physical condition. I ride a bicycle probably about 40 miles a week, because I figure if you're going to have to move yourself and not jump in a car, then you need to be in shape. You need to be able to go 20 miles on a trip on a bicycle. And taking care of yourself and not depending on the government to take care of you. And I don't want to sound like a Tea Partier, because I'm not. I've been a lifelong Democrat. Not anymore, because I think, the current political situation is so depraved that the people that are running, the Democrats, the Republicans, they're both, everybody's sold out to the corporation. It's just one group.
Now. Yeah, and
it's the corporate reverse totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a charismatic person necessarily running it, because Barack Obama, as charismatic as he is owned by the special interests.
And in that light of things, the things that we have come to depend on being supplied by the government probably won't be there anyway. Just simply by legislative decision making, that's where they're going. They're taking away Social Security, Medicare, health care, all of that stuff. So we do need to be setting up either communities or options for ourselves, because the government can't be counted on to do that. Is that where you're going with that?
Yes, that's exactly right, because the people have walked away. I met a young, he's not a young person, but he had decided when he was 16 years old, he said, I'm going to outlive my culture, and I'm going to do something about that now. He's now approaching 60 years old, and he said, although I did work in the corporate world for a short time until I was about 24, he said, when I was 24, I decided I don't want any part of this anymore, and he said, and he followed this trip until he got to the trust in New Mexico, where I interviewed him, where he was approaching 60, and I said, well, what are you going to do when you get old and sick? He says, man, I've already written my will, you know, whatever personal effects I have. He said, but if I get sick, that's kind of it. You know, it's over. I'm not going to check myself into a critical care facility. I'm going to stay here with the people that I've lived with for the past 15 years of his life and living in a small permaculture settlement, feeding yourself off the land, living close to the land, and a lifestyle change. And he's not a scientist. He was an artist. And I said, how did you know that? And he said, I just knew it in my heart. So people are figuring this out intellectually, but artists are already intuiting that this is information that they're getting from somewhere else. That's why they're artists.
So do you think this has the potential to become a movement? I mean, there was something...
It's already a movement.
It already is, yeah.
It's way too... a lot of people are kind of... This is not esoteric. It's a big thing. And a lot of... There are transition groups all over the world. There are, I think they started somewhere in Surrey, England, and they kind of spread out from there. But, to be a transition town, for instance, you have to meet certain criteria. You can't just say we're a transition town. You have to actually meet the criteria to be a transition town.
And some transition groups...
The idea of living closer and locally...
Yes, that's the principle behind it. Now, some transition groups are, my take on it from what I've talked to people with, the groups I've talked to, some are more serious about it than others in the sense that they take it more urgently. The ones who say, well, someday, you know, we're going to have a system in place that we can go away from, stop consuming oil, they take their time. The ones who see an urgency, like they're putting two and two together, like you've done, and they're saying, we got to get this together fast because it's going to all slip away from us. The grid's going down. They are, like, cranking. You know, they're turning acres and acres of lawns and golf courses into farms in their communities. What's your observation on the – now, that's my opinion, but what's your observation about that?
Actually, I think I'm in complete agreement with what you just said, because it's part of the process. And collapse does not have to be like everybody, when they think of collapse, they think of a Mad Max scenario where we're ruled by, you know, warlords and we're living in some Afghanistan Stone Age. But it doesn't have to be that way because, you see, we're not going to collapse back down, you know, back to the Stone Age, but I think we can create a culture through a process of imagining something different and perhaps better as a lifestyle. It may not involve tweeting or the internet, but it could involve being, like, for instance, Sherry Ackerman. I'm going to be filming up there in June. I'll be up there for about a week, and she's got a hermitage up there, and she's kind of a spiritual teacher, but she walked away back in the early 70s. You know, she was touched by the anti-war movement that kind of touched a lot of us back then. And she went to Vermont, lived in a commune, and now she has her own hermitage up in Mount Shasta, and I'll be filming there in June.
Great. Yeah, I've heard of her. And which kind of connects nicely that whole, because there was a back to the land movement back in the late 60s, 70s, it sort of crumbled away. Well, a lot of things came out of it that were really great. Organic farming and, you know, herbal medicine. I mean, fantastic things came out of it. But it was like the corporate world sort of turned it into a brand, kind of like how revolution happened. It looked like there might be a revolution back then, but it got turned into a brand, and suddenly no revolution. It's just special clothes you get to wear that are fancy. And what you're talking about here is that we're actually looking at, things are crumbling. We had tons of resources then by comparison. now things are really getting serious.
But it's only getting serious if you imagine that this is the only way we can live. And we've only lived like this for a very short period of history. And unfortunately, you know, my life as well as your life, and everybody who might be happening to listen to this, have lived our entire lives in that little bubble. And what we need to do is engage our imagination, that we can imagine a different way of living, and a different way of living with each other. We don't have to live in cities alienated by apartments and rents and creating a sense of a gift community among each other. And it's not like, you know, I got mine, pull up the ladder, Jake. It's like, how can we help our brothers and sisters? Because that, I'm not a Christian, although I was raised in a Catholic, strict Catholic family and went to a Catholic school for 12 years. I really have to reject the whole idea of that there's some being above us. I mean, if you want to look at the world and see what's wonderful, just look down. You don't have to look up. Unless you've got some great clouds up there. Mm-hmm. But the world around us is such a fascinating cosmology that it's like any imagination I might have about the next world pales in comparison to the world that you can see, particularly when you can see and recognize a healthy ecosystem, which does not have any economic value, unfortunately.
Right.
If it did, we might be trying to save them.
Yeah, that would be the... that's the connection. That's one of the missing connections, is that without a healthy ecosystem, we don't have an economy. I mean, that's a kind of a missing piece. And it looks as though the industrial civilization side of things has made a choice. They made a decision that you and I are not important. Our lives don't matter. We're not really worth a pile of compost to them. It's all about grabbing the next pile of resources from whatever country that can be invaded and have it taken from. It's just galloping toward this accumulating what's left, really, and trying to like float on top of this huge debt that's in the economy. It's whereas the natural world is some sort of very foreign place that's simply kind of like washed up and overutilized right now from the point of view of the industrial civilization. I don't know, I'm getting off on this thing, but
actually, I really like where you're going, Daniel, because that was kind of my experience when I lived in Los Angeles. I lived in Los Angeles for about 14 years, and I raised my kids there. I had two sons, and I lived in El Segundo, which to the north was LAX Airport, where I worked. And to the west was the Hyperion plant and the Edison Electric. And to the south was the JP4 plant, or Standard Oil. That's why it's called El Segundo, because it was the first Standard Oil facility on the West Coast. And then to the east was the military industrial complex that went on for miles and miles. And it was this small little illusion in the middle of this massive globe-eating thing, which was civilization. And we lived in this little Andy of Mayberry. It was almost like being in Twilight Zone. If you've ever gone to El Segundo, you go through, it's like the Twilight Zone. You come into this little town, but all of a sudden you'll hear planes coming across the top of the town, and you're going, oh, this isn't really Andy of Mayberry, it's just an illusion. Yes.
Yeah.
And they literally kept the town in this kind of, this 1950s vision of how the world should be. And,
yes,
you know, we even had like old car days. But we lived in that little hamlet for 12 years. And when I was a Boy Scout leader, all the kids wanted to do was go camping somewhere, because they had never seen the outdoors. Their parents had never, because you have to drive, you know, 150 miles to go anywhere that's natural,
right,
away from that.
And you got to fight the traffic to get out of town.
And you've got to fight the traffic to get out of there. And it's like just living in this horrible civilization that you can't escape from. It's just ubiquitous everywhere.
Yeah, and the UPS planes are coming in for a landing, and they're dropping fuel out, excess fuel out on you.
What they're trying to do, because I was a controller, they're trying to balance their gas tanks. The gas tanks are in the wings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to balance them, so they're dropping fuel as they're coming across. Most of it never reaches the ground because it goes right into the atmosphere, so you're breathing this horrible stuff. And, you know, they talk about contrails. You know, we knew about contrails a long time ago. They don't have any type of catalytic converters on the back of those planes. That's JP4. They're burning. Highly toxic. It's just as toxic as you can imagine.
Wow. So it may not be some sort of intentional hallucinogen or some conspiracy theory type of chemical. It's just plain toxic.
It's just
plain old toxic.
But everything about the hydrocarbons are filthy and toxic because it's a complex, you know, that's why everything we have anymore is plastic. And we're totally dependent on this plastic stuff. We now have a sea of it that's bigger than the continental United States and the Pacific. And that terrifies me. I don't know why, but it scares the hell out of me. That they've got this gyre. They've even named it gyre.
The gyre.
And all this plastic sitting there, and it breaks down into its simplest form, which is, you know, smaller little pellets. And these pellets happen to look like life. So everything's eating the plastic and dying from it. And I'm thinking to myself, are we just going to drive off the cliff, you know, and just this stupid rush to keep everything going? You know, for me, the great fear is that we're going to try and keep this thing going for as long as possible. And we're going to degrade the environment so much that it won't recover in any type of human lifetime, and most of us are going to probably go extinct by the end of the century. And the only one who would actually care about that would be perhaps us, because, you know, we're not a special species. And that's been the myth, that we thought we were special, and we're not. We're just a species.
We're just another species. And Mike Sosby, filmmaker on Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time, which is the subject of that film, Guy McPherson, Dr. Guy McPherson, professor emeritus from University of Arizona. So one of the things that he advocates is, first of all, he doesn't advocate it. He just flatly says there's nothing that he sees anywhere that is like a magic pill, magic bullet, magic wand or magic technology that's going to come and suddenly and quickly replace oil, suddenly and quickly clean up the gyre, do all that and make everything pristine again, that the only way to go is to start dropping out of industrial civilization. So there must be some appeal to that, to you, Mike Sosby, filmmaker. Want to comment on that?
You know, looking forward to, I care about my family and I care about my friends, and I don't want anybody that I know to die in a natural or painful death. And that's one of the reasons that I just quit eating meat, even though I love hamburgers. I mean, I just looked at that and I said, well, you know what, it's kind of immoral to have somebody else murdering some animal somewhere. It's nameless, and I'm going to eat, you know. So we have to become guilty to a certain extent and say, I'm participating in this. I'm participating every time I drive a car, every time I flip on a light and I expect the electricity to be there. I use my computer. I do all, but, you know, I turned off my television. I did that. I stopped watching TV last year, and I tell you what, it's probably the greatest thing I've done in my life for myself is stop watching television altogether, because I was addicted to sports.
Yeah. The only thing I miss about TV myself is baseball, but I can go to the local ballpark and watch people play.
Watch people play. Now you're talking. If you're going to go to an actual ballpark and watch physical people play, but watching everything on TV, we're caught up in this fiction, because everything is a derivative of real life. And we're okay with it because we're sitting in our living room and we're experiencing the world. And that's such a small, shallow experience level. I wish people were a little more daring than they are.
Well, you know, this is where individual filmmaking and going out with a message and bringing it to small venues. Nice if it's on TV, sure. Sure, it'll reach people. But what you're doing is you have an event coming up in Oceanside, which is where you now live. Correct? Do you live in Oceanside?
Yeah, I live in Oceanside, California.
Okay.
And I've had a relationship with the Audubon here in Oceanside. We do the bird counts annually, and I've been involved with ecological restoration down here since about 2007, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I've been associated with them for a long time, and when I decided where I wanted to film Guy McPherson, I chose the Buena Vista Audubon Nature Center, and it's just kind of a beautiful, accessible place that children are brought into, and they're allowed to actually interact with real ecosystems and learn what birds do and learn that there's this natural world that you know nothing about, and it doesn't happen to be landscaping with grass and shrubbery. It's like there's some birds out there, and as soon as you put in natural environments, guess what? All the birds come back.
Hmm.
And there's the system of lagoons in California that's part of the floristic province, and it's one of the 12 biodiverse hotspots on the planet. And
wow.
So it's important work to try and restore the ecosystems and what is left of them. Try and bring them back, because if you leave them alone for a long enough time
and stop interfering
with the ecosystems, they'll actually come back. They're very resilient.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The positive part of the message is if you stop with the earth for a while, it'll come back. It'll come back of its own accord. It's a very forgiving thing. But we're going to have to give it a break for a couple of hundred years.
So what you're going to do there at the Audubon Center is now you're going to be doing a pre-showing of the film somewhere in New Mexico before the end of time. And you're also doing, this is also a fundraiser, isn't it, for the to bring together the money for the completion of the film? Is that part of it too?
Yeah, I've had an Indiegogo program that I've been running, and it's been very successful. We brought in several thousand dollars on that kind of paid the production costs. I'm not paying myself. It's just there's certain people I have to hire. And for instance, the event, we'll have a two-camera shoot. I've got a sound person. And we're also bringing in a group of musicians that we're going to record the soundtrack, because I believe in using original music. So I happen to be fortunate enough to know a lot of great musicians. So they've volunteered to come in and do the soundtrack for the film.
Yeah, you filmed a lot of musicians.
Yeah, yes, I have. And San Diego is very rich in musicians down here. So I've always had a great association with the musician, and particularly the blues group in San Diego.
So this event is coming up it's coming up in Oceanside on Saturday, June 1st. And we're going to rush this onto our podcast.
Is that June 1st or is that June 2nd?
I'm sorry. It's Saturday,
yes,
June 2nd. Yeah, yes, Friday's June 1st. Okay, Saturday,
yeah.
June 2nd. And it's at the Audubon Center in Oceanside, California, which is between a little north of San Diego, right? It's along the coast.
It's actually between Carlsbad and Oceanside, which is North County,
okay.
San Diego.
North San Diego
County.
County.
San Diego.
And
very close to, you know, I'm right next to the Marine base here, and you know, I see these young men, you know, on their third deployments going out of here, and it's really, you know, an ugly thing. And I just wanted to bring up that it's Veterans Day today, and I'm a decorated veteran. I spent 4 years in the military, and I was and I'm appalled at what my government is currently doing with these perpetual wars that are designed to keep everybody frightened. We've got to keep this war going because the war is part of the economy. They've got to keep it going. And so stop the war. Let's bring the troops home. Let's move away from this whole imperialist idea.
Yeah, well, the army is really just a resource extraction police force. At the moment, that's basically what the U.S. Armed Forces are. They're a resource extraction police force.
that's interesting that you say that, because a lot of people don't recognize that that's why we have this huge military.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want to get people to give up their stuff, you have to intimidate them. You got to say, man, we're the bad boys on the planet, and you cross us, it's not going to be healthy for you. And we've got these bombs that suck the oxygen out of people's lungs. That's how they kill them. They literally compress their lungs, and they're impact bombs. And anybody within a certain range of that impact bomb, when it goes off, it literally kills them with it, sucks the oxygen out of their lungs. And I'm thinking, who invents this kind of evil, and who buys it?
Yes. You know, that's going to be a subject of another interview somewhere. More exploration. And you know what I want to do is listeners, if you have if what you've been hearing is something where you're in accord and you're interested, so this is where there's a website for you to visit. And Mike Sosby, who is our guest here on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio, is going to give you the where to find more information about his films and where to find out more information about the fundraising effort to complete somewhere in New Mexico. So, Mike, take it away.
Mostly, I post on Facebook.
Okay.
And I have a channel, Sosby2, on YouTube.
And that's,
I post my films there.
Well, let's spell that. It's S-O-S-E-B-E-E, correct?
Yes.
I have that right?
S-O-S-E-B-E-2.
Number two.
That's on YouTube, and it's got my channel. But primarily what I'm focused on right now is promoting this film and the message of the film,
mm-hmm.
which is about kind of the predicament we're in right now. And it's somewhere in New Mexico before the end of time, and there is a lot of references to that film.
Yeah, you can Google it. It's around.
Google.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, okay. Well, fantastic. This has been a great interview. And yes, it is the official Memorial Day today, and we've definitely given a hat tip and a nod to maybe some things that we could really be putting our efforts into.
Free Bradley Manning. How about that?
There we go. That's it. That's a great way to be moving this forward. So thank you very much for joining us on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. Mike Sosby, best of luck to you on the project. We will be following this. And I would like to find out what it would take to do a screening of it up in Northern California in the North Bay. So let's definitely stay in touch, okay?
Hey, thank you, Daniel.